When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/realid or visit your local DMV.
That's what I'm thinking. I don't even know who they would replace him with.
That's my thing. That's why I'm like, I feel like it's like a chicken in the hard place. You know what I mean? Chicken, no, rock in the...
yeah.
Rock in the hard place. Chicken in the hard place. I don't even know what that means. Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense.
Hey, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Sadie, and I'm here with my friend Amanda. Say hello, Amanda.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
If you guys are like, where the heck is Rachel? As I mentioned, or we mentioned in the previous episode, but we mentioned towards the end, so you may have missed it. Rachel has some childcare challenges today. And so we decided to have Amanda Peterson back on the podcast. If you guys remember, we did an interview with her a few episodes back focused on foreign policy. And now that we have wrapped up the first very calm and easy 100 days of the Trump administration, we did an episode on the first 100 days, but now I wanted to do one that focused on foreign policy. So I have a pretty good understanding of Trump's foreign policy, but I love talking to you because I feel like I can get more in depth about it. So this should be fun.
Yes. Thank you so much again for having me. I'm really excited about this. Totally not a chaotic 100 days. Nothing really happened. So I don't really know what we're going to talk about, but we'll find something.
The goal is foreign policy first 100 days. Obviously, he had made a lot of promises first coming in. I also want to talk a little bit on what the heck is going on over at the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
Yeah. There seems to be like, I know generally what is happening over there, but I haven't been following it closely. So I know we have gotten a lot of questions on that. So I thought that would be a good thing to touch on. But before we get started, let me, if this is your first time here, welcome. You have found your new favorite podcast. Please hit that follow button so you don't miss the next episode. And if you would like to be listening to the podcast without any advertisement and with bonus content, there is a link in the show notes for becoming a paying subscriber over at our Substack, which gets you all kinds of goodies. Okay. Oh, and by the way, we also have merch now, which I was very excited about. Yeah, we just started merch. It's just for fun. I did a whole, like, there's an inside joke. I don't know how much you have had a chance to listen, but I have a habit of calling Marco Rubio Mario Rubio. Like, I screw up people's names all the time. Scott Jennings. I call him Ken Jennings all the time. Anyways, there's a t-shirt there for Mario Rubio, which I think is hilarious. Okay.
I love it.
It's his, what is it called? His, what do you call that book? That yearbook picture. It's his yearbook picture on it, which I thought was really, he was very handsome when he was a young man. Anyways, yes. Let's get into today's episode. So first of all, Trump came in hot. Okay. Mm-hmm. Clearly. Mm-hmm. Even before he started his presidency, Trump 2.0, he made a lot of really bold promises on the campaign trail. Putting an end to the Russian war, putting an end to the conflict with Gaza and Israel, peace through strength. He talks a lot about how, like, he didn't have any new wars during his first administration. And I know it's only 100 days in, and I think he very boldly, like the salesman that he is, declared that he was going to end all of this on day one, which was not practical in any way, shape, or form. The Democrats love to point that out. He said, he said day one. But in general, considering the goals of the administration, how his past administration managed foreign policy, like, how are you seeing his first 100 days and his attempt to bring peace and also reshape U.S. global priorities. Oh, and I forgot to mention China. So yeah, China.
That's a big one. Yeah. My whole understanding of Trump's foreign policy really is just, it all makes sense when you understand the China threat and being more open about the China threat and taking it, in my opinion, more seriously. Not that the Biden administration wasn't taking it seriously, but I just think there's like an old school approach and a new school approach. And I think Trump is definitely in the new school. Definitely, he came in with a lot of hyperbolic statements. I'm going to end these on day one. Obviously, that didn't happen. I think people who understand Trump know we take him seriously, not always literally. And I think the Democrats like to take him literally, but not seriously. And I think that that's where that confusion comes from. I guess in the first 100 days, like for specifics, I think that this deal between Russia and Ukraine might be kind of close. And I don't know. I mean, I think when we look back at his first term, we looked at the successes, right? The no new wars, things like that. And so we kind of forgot that the first term was pretty chaotic, like probably more so than
yeah,
this one.
I remember too, because I didn't even mention, which I think Iran will probably come up to when we start talking mm-hmm. about the DOD and Hegseth and stuff. But I remember during his first administration, there was always this, we're on the brink of World mm-hmm. War III. He did a strike on, oh my gosh, my brain just blanked out.
Qasem Soleimani.
Yes. Thank you. This is why you're here.
The leader of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. He was a celebrity in the Middle East. If he was walking around anywhere in Iraq and Syria, kids would run to go take a picture with him because he was such an all-encompassing leader. I was worried when Trump ordered the strike on him because I was like, this is
big deal.
And a big thing that gets lost in when Trump did that is Xi Jinping was at Mar-a-Lago, like at the dinner table with him when Trump ordered that strike. Yes. And obviously Xi didn't know. And so China and Iran had a relationship. It's closer now, but yeah, they had a relationship and Trump ordered the strike on the basically number three in charge. And the Iranian regime really is not even so much a religious clerical regime anymore as much as it is like a military one. Like it's kind of moved in that direction. They're so much more militaristic than
very different from when they were first founded in 79.
Definitely. And so for Trump to order that and kind of have people kind of around and Xi could figure out something going on, I mean, kind of flexing his muscles that way. If you read Jared Kushner's book, I think it was Jared Kushner's book where he talks about just how provocative and daring that was. And again, even you go back to the first term, Trump was concerned about China, but he's willing to keep that door open. But that was an instance where
and that's the thing, because I guess it's just funny like how they're trying to frame it. And specifically, like when you mention thinking that this Ukraine-Russia agreement is close. I mean, did you think that before? Because breaking news, quote unquote, but late yesterday, unless you guys were following on my Instagram feed or whatever, or are following the headlines, the U.S. and Ukraine did finally sign a rare earth mineral deal that gives U.S. access to mining rare earths in Ukraine, which was one of the big deals and one of the things that actually Rachel and I would talk about often in the beginning when this was like even a first idea, because it was kind of, we saw it as like a workaround of having a U.S. presence without having a U.S. presence. Mm-hmm. And that being used, not only is it being beneficial to the United States because it gives us access to these minerals and these resources, but also because it could work as a deterrent from Russia of like just charging over Ukraine. So honestly, like we come 100 days in, let's like focus in a little bit now that we're kind of talking about it on Ukraine and Russia. Mm-hmm. You have the Pope passes. Mm-hmm. Everybody, all these leaders meet in the Vatican for his funeral. And you have that meeting where it's just two chairs, two dudes facing each other in this insane setting of, I don't even know where they were, but it was gorgeous. Mm-hmm. What was your perception of that conversation? Obviously, we don't know exactly what was discussed, but just kind of like how the optics and how things have developed since that conversation, considering before the conversation, now that we have this mineral deal signed And do you really think that, because Putin's been kind of agitating too. Putin, there was like right before the funeral.
Like the strikes on,
yeah,
strikes on Sunday and on Kyiv.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, a lot of people are saying clearly he's not interested in peace. And so Trump is failing because he's agitating.
Yet, if you look at Russia's history, where every time they're about to make some sort of a deal, they always go heavier on strikes. They did that in Syria all the time. So I think that that's kind of Putin's way of going into the negotiations from a position of strength, targeting civilians. This is not a good guy. You know what I mean?
We mallow.
So we all know this, but it's like awful. So he's done this before. So I'm disheartened to see it, but I'm not surprised, I guess. I think there's a lot of noise when it comes to Russia, Ukraine. But when I'm saying like old school versus new school, I think that Trump, right or wrong with the way he goes about it. And that's usually when you really shake people out on Trump's foreign policy, you'll always kind of get to a place with them where they say, no, I understand that what he's doing needs to be done. I just don't like the way he does it.
Oh, all the time. All the time. And everything, just, not just foreign policy.
Right. But when it comes to Russia, Ukraine, I think I said this the last time we recorded, but, you know, we've known how this war would end since January 2023. Our security establishment had a report that was put out by the Naval War College, I believe, that said that this would end in some sort of Korean style disengagement around about the lines that it's being settled now. And Biden, the entire time he was in office, he would slow drip weapons. So the Ukrainians would request something to go on a counteroffensive, and he would give them 3 to 4 months late. And apparently he was just so pro-Ukraine. I mean, Ukrainians were dying waiting for those weapons too. Trump is the one who actually was able to get them to the table. And I think that that's worth something. And for as much as going back and forth, I mean, I was pretty disappointed after that meeting with that initial meeting with Zelensky. All of these headlines are coming out. Trump's going to rescind every Ukrainian visa here. And that never happened. A lot of that was propaganda. And kind of where we're left here is that this minerals deal is going to get done. Again, it's more new school than old school. And I can explain that. And I do think that we're kind of close to one of these deals. I just saw a headline this morning and I only got to read half the article, but Putin or Russia, their birth rate has like massively declined. They don't have
enough
nobody's
people.
Having kids anymore. The Ukrainians understand a population crisis and what could come of that. The Russians understand it. If they both want to have a country in 10 to 15 years, they need people to be having kids and replacing the birth rate, unless they want to do what we did in the West and start mass immigration there.
Which would completely upheave like Russia. It would just be a complete change of, which is the complete opposite of what Putin and the Russian leadership want. I mean, they're pretty like staunch in like maintaining their Russian identity. So I don't see that happening.
I mean, if you just look at the one-time signing bonus for a person to join the army there, $40,000 in American dollars. And that's not including their big salary. How much longer can Putin float that? We don't know. I mean, we're getting oil barrel prices down. That's how they fund their economy, is oil. It's coming down. I think even though rhetorically Trump is not as tough on Putin as Biden maybe was or Blinken, there's things going on behind the scenes which are making Putin come to the deal. And I guess if I were to say anything, it's that Trump and Zelensky are not compelled to make this deal based on American rhetoric. They're compelled to make the deal based on what they're seeing on the battlefield and what they know that they can achieve and what they want for their populations long term and stuff like that. And so I actually think that we're on a good path with that. But when I say like old school versus new school, I think the understanding that we are coming to, and Trump is kind of forcing people to, is that the way that we've been doing things for about the last 30 years, like since the Soviet Union fell,
it's like a lot of back channel shuttling back and forth negotiations, people not really talking to each other, sanctions. As opposed to, I feel like this administration is much more face to face. I mean, they immediately are sending envoys or the Secretary of State to have conversations, or Trump's on the phone with them, like
much more public diplomacy like that. And I think that just comes down to Trump being a reality TV producer, kind of at his core. But I also think that we kind of got into, I mean, like, look, when the Soviet Union fell, the United States and our allies were just so dominant, and particularly the United States, we couldn't conceive of having a peer competitor. And we stopped spending as much on our defense, and we engaged in wars that many would call frivolous, or we kind of did things, I guess.
Like, which allowed Russia and China to kind of rise to power. And now we have...
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
And we talked about it as if, oh, nobody's ever going to, this is just an American decision. If America says something, it's going to get done. And that makes us feel very good to our foreign policy elite and stuff. But it wasn't really the case. And we stopped spending as much on our defense. Our allies stopped spending. They're not in the place that they need to be. We probably aren't in the place that we need to be. And I mean, when you looked at deterrence and stuff, they could kind of say, if you don't want nuclear proliferation, and you don't want all of us to get nukes, I think Kennedy predicted that 36 countries would have had nuclear weapons by the time he was maybe 10 years out from his presidency in the 60s. I think we're at 9, maybe a 10th if Iran gets a nuke, which I don't think that that's going to be allowed to happen.
Yeah.
And so all of our allies, if they can just look at us and say, if you're not going to come defend us, then maybe we're going to.
They're going to have to defend themselves, you know,
Considering
that we're like 100 days in and clearly not only was it that Trump's policy, he's saying, I'm going to bring peace, or that's his claim, like he can with a wand. But also, like, he is completely restructuring U.S. global
order,
not only economically, which was a whole other that's a whole other story, but you know, in defense itself, because he is forcing our allies. I don't know if he's accomplishing it. You tell me. But the goal is to force our allies to fend for themselves more, too, because one of the reasons that they've been able to provide their population with all of these social programs is because they don't spend money on defense and they're expecting the United States to protect them. And now,
because that's how it was laid out, that was like kind of the deal we made, and we kind of let them slide on not spending as much, and because we didn't think that there would be this big threat, and we didn't spend as much maybe to maintain things. And so now we're kind of in a position where Trump, I actually think the economics of it all is kind of intertwined, like this is going to be a partnership now. And I think that he's threading kind of a fine needle if he doesn't want nuclear proliferation. That's kind of the thing I'm more scared about. But basically saying, hey, look, like, this is going to be a partnership between us and you. And we're not going to be the first line. You're going to be the first line. And we're going to be the second line. And we'll come in and help you. But we need this, this, and this from you. And I think that that's kind of what the minerals deal is a part of. I think something that hasn't been talked about a lot, but I've heard Scott Bessent talk about, the Treasury Secretary, is Trump is thinking in terms of wanting to have a new asset class. So he wants to do this. What is that called again?
Oh, he called it some kind of fund.
Like, yes. Sovereign wealth fund.
Yes. There we go.
He wants to do the sovereign wealth fund and put things like the Ukrainian minerals deal in there. And then Americans can buy it like we would buy shares of the S&P 500 or something and have that kind of
so
fund.
So almost kind of like Treasury bonds, kind of like a concept of treasury bonds, maybe. I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily a fair comparison, but like treasury bonds are things that other countries, businesses, whoever can purchase and invest. They have a very stable interest rate. If you want to make big money fast and risk, you go to the stock market. If you want to make steady money that you can trust, it's the bond market. And the bond market funds the U.S. economy directly, as opposed to the stock market is private business. So like that would be like a general explanation of how those two work. So in this sovereign wealth fund, it would be something similar maybe to the bond market, as in like it's actual, as opposed to, I don't want to say made up money.
Yeah.
They're a little made up, but not just in the fact that they're not tangible. Let's just say that. So the sovereign wealth fund would be more about like tangible, almost like commodities maybe, or yeah, that sort of thing.
And we would put some of these deals in it so Americans have skin in the game. Another thing about when we just talk about rare earth minerals, two things to say on this deal specifically. I'm seeing this compared to like Chinese deals, like China's Belt and Road Initiative,
I mean, I see that like someone trying to make that stretch, but I don't see it at all.
Yeah, nowhere near similar. So with the Belt and Road Initiative, that was introduced in 2013, and China will give these kind of loans that they kind of know the country will default on to countries in the global south. And once they default on these, it's for like infrastructure projects.
Yeah, it's an underhanded way to take control of other countries mm-hmm. without invading the country. So
totally.
People will try and argue that the Belt and Road Initiative of China is a version of the United States USAID, which is why there's been such a cry about the cut in USAID, because it's the soft power mm-hmm. version of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And that by us cutting back, we're kind of like ceding ground to China is the argument that's being made. I don't know if that's necessarily fair, because at the end of the day, I would hope that some countries would have enough common sense knowing that if you do this business with China, like when you start putting apples to apples compared to each other, instead of the United States investing in trans operas in Senegal or whatever, maybe they actually do some type of infrastructure or something that actually helps the country itself, now that we're not spending money on trans ideology, and it can be a competitor to this Belt and Road Initiative. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, this is me kind of like making things up of how I think things would be beneficial if this is what the route the United States took. Then my thought would be you would want to go with the United States, which actually doesn't want to have you default and take your land, versus China, who wants you to default so they can take your land.
Totally. Well, that's the best way to look at it, is like China, there's a coercive component that we just don't have with our USAID and anything else. But when people try and relate the two, I mean, this minerals deal that was just signed, it's 50-50 ownership. It's not 51-49. Mm-hmm. Neither us or the Ukrainians have a veto power. We only make money if they make money. So we're actually incentivized to make them make money. And the race for rare earth minerals, China owns or has relationships with the majority of countries in the world that have rare earths. They're actually not that rare, despite the name. We have some here.
They're rare because of access to them.
Yeah. But these are what go into making semiconductors, so the computer chips that are going to power AI. So like we had the race for oil after World War I, that's kind of what the race for rare earths is going to be. And so, yes, this is kind of a deal that maybe could go into a sovereign wealth fund should Trump do that. And I think he is going to do that. But also, yes, can give a deterrent effect and stuff. But really, I mean, this is going to be something that we need. And our foreign policy partnerships moving forward are going to be partnerships where we get something out of them and they get something out of them. They get the defense, but they can't screw us on trade or something.
Yeah.
Or they need to, we get to their rare earths.
Which is the goal of this administration. It's mm-hmm. not to, I really don't think the goal of this administration is to isolate us. It's just to create an opportunity that is more, that has more balance, because I hate to make the comparison, but it's been like, I don't know, since World War II, it's been like a DEI initiative. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's who's the most marginalized country. And therefore, because we're the most successful, we need to share the wealth or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that was part of it. Is, oh, here's this emerging democracy, we're going to fund them and we don't really care what they're doing on the side. And that was like the right wing equivalent. And then the left wing came in and they took the same ideology, like neocon ideology, but they just said, instead of helping democracies, we're just going to help the little guy, mm-hmm. the marginalized people. And we don't really care if the little guy's Hamas and they're like killing people. Like, it's really crazy. It's like, we can play kingmaker. And guess what? We could play kingmaker 25 years ago. We can't really play kingmaker now because we have a peer competitor.
Yeah.
And so when I talked about population decline in Russia and Ukraine, we kind of face similar things here. People are not giving birth above like reporting.
And I mean,
here.
Honestly, it's interesting because when you mentioned that, one of the first things that popped into my head was China also is having mm-hmm. some population, like all of these major countries, advancing countries, because I would without question say that China is an advancing country, are having population like issues. Honestly, most of the population is growing in Africa and like South Asia, but you're not seeing it in Europe, United States, Russia, or China. I think China's actually most of it self-imposed because for a long time they had the one child policy. And then I think right now, culturally within China, because of the imbalance of the one child policy, and there's such a load on the younger generation to take care of the older generation, there's become this underlying almost resistance to the weight of the responsibility of having to have children. They feel like they can't do it all because it's one child taking care of two generations. Because it's not just their parents, but sometimes it's their grandparents too. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a movement, I think, of not working, not participating or something.
And there's way more men than women.
Yeah. And that's all they wanted, which would cause a population issue.
Right. But like, this is something that we need to contend with in the West. I do think that USAID is important, and not the trans operas, but soft power is important in all of those things. If we understand that if we have population decline, we're not going to be bringing in as much tax revenue. We don't want to significantly increase taxes. But that also means that we can't have our own welfare state like the Europeans created, because theirs isn't sustainable either with their birth rates. We're not going to be able to keep up our position in the world if it's contingent on keeping up our military spending and USAID, if we're not going to have the tax base to support that in 15 years. It'll be longer than that. But something needed to change. So Trump is changing it. And I actually don't criticize necessarily the way he's doing it or the way he talks about it. Again, this isn't a rhetoric problem of Trump. It's not just he could be nicer about it. Most of these countries are not friendly with us because we're nicer to them. They understand, even if we're being, look,
it's, that talking it's point has always drove me nuts. This whole like, oh, just be nice and everybody's going to be so tolerant because everybody at their core is a good person. And I'm like, no, not every country, not every culture has the same principles or the same way of communicating or receives messaging in the same way. Like, sometimes you need to be like, sit your butt down, fool, and look, you do.
The world order has existed the way it has, where it's okay, you can have a deal with China and you can deal with them and have access to where growth is happening, Asia. I mean, all of the Asian countries, but, you know, China's becoming more and more hostile and more coercive. And then you can still deal with the Americans and we're not going to be mean to you. And you can come to us for defense and stuff. I mean, this is like the predicament the Europeans are in. Yeah. They've dealt with this Asian markets, American security, Russian cheap energy. And we're trying to tell them, okay, you got to pick a few. If your choice is China for the markets and Russia for the energy, then don't expect us to keep footing this bill for Ukraine. And don't expect us to foot the whole bill for NATO anymore either.
Yeah. You're aligning your interests with someone who's active, like with our enemies or who are actively trying to undermine the United States. You know, you're talking about China and all of these South Asian countries. Now, India and China are not friends.
Yeah.
Can you explain exactly why India and China aren't friends? Because there are murmurings, obviously. I don't want to get too deep into trade, but the trade deals do have a foreign policy element to them. And so my assumption is that one of the moves that the administration is trying to make is that through trade deals, especially with Indo-Pacific countries, South Asian countries, is kind of like a way to it's almost like forcing China out via a type of sanctions. And so the rumor is that either India or Japan are probably going to be one of the first trade deals that actually get penned and panned out, hopefully soon, because that would be very important. Yeah. But I don't want to get into economic discussions. How significant in relation with our foreign policy with China would a trade deal with India, do you think India would be?
Oh, I think it'd be massively significant. I think we saw that headline last week where Apple's going to move a lot of its manufacturing from China to India. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a lobbying effort right now for a lot of these countries over there. It's okay, if you're going to have to get out of China, come here. And that's a big deal for them. The dispute between India and China is a longstanding one. It's a border dispute, basically. Tibet, like that kind of region.
Yeah.
We don't have to go more specifically than that. But I mean, they've had a lot of tension for a long time. And it's been relatively calm for a while. And India would like to keep it that way. So they're not going to go we hate China. That's not what's going to happen with them. They worried about all of these countries in the Indo-Pacific looking at China and their increasing, like, the building of islands in the South China Sea and how hostile they've been and how they're constantly washing fishermen in the sea and they're doing all these military exercises around Taiwan. And one of these days, it's not going to be an exercise and we're not really going to have that big of a warning like we had with the Russians in Ukraine. When the Russians invaded Ukraine, we knew for about a month that that was going to happen. And people were still saying, oh, it might not happen. And now one of these days, they're just going to go and it's and not going to be good. Like,
no,
it's not going to be fun. So all of these countries are looking at China. They don't want to be openly hostile to them, but they want to kind of reassure and make sure that they would be able to deal with the Chinese.
And I would think
they want
to
hedge.
Yeah. And I would think that those trade deals would also factor in. I mean, it would be a negative impact in the power and the influence that China has. Possibly. I mean, is that maybe one of the goals? Just like through, because you're so heavy and dependent on manufacturing, if you were to take one of their major sources of income, which is manufacturing, and it gets distributed through other countries, that would lessen their power. Now, the problem is that China doesn't necessarily care about their population, which is another challenge to deal with.
But they have inner party dynamics that they have to cater to. And I think that Xi is not super popular among the whole Chinese Communist Party. We can't know for sure because obviously they don't have a free press and we don't really get reporting on these things. But I mean, if you look at Xi, he said he was going to run for two terms and he's running for his fourth in 2027. That cuts out a whole generation of leadership that wanted to move up in the CCP that can't. And if you look at these military firings that he's done over the last few months to a year, there's probably some tension between the CCP and the PLA, and I don't want to speculate too much on it because
nobody knows, but you see possibilities of something brewing there.
Yeah. If you follow Gordon Chang, he talks about, I think it was him, all of these communist authoritarian regimes always seem super, super powerful right until they fall. And so maybe the CCP kind of crumbles. I don't know. But I don't know. When people talk about China, because you don't have the you don't really see the chaos out there. People act, oh, they're progressing and they don't have any problems. No,
it's been wild. Some of the propaganda that's been coming out of China. Like I've been seeing like these AI generated videos where they're campaigns against the United States, calling the United States a bully and that China won't back down and they won't. And they're all in English. They're all but they're clearly AI generated. And it's actually pretty freaking weird and creepy.
I was thinking about this, like, I'm incredibly worried about China. Like, I'm incredibly worried about, I don't think that we've taken that threat seriously enough. I think what you're saying about the trade deals is absolutely correct. A lot of it won't be, okay, you need to reduce your tariffs to zero on us in certain categories, but you got to increase, you got to start buying these weapons from us. You got to increase your defense spending here. You've got to do this and that. You've got to close loopholes and stuff. I'm incredibly worried about China, though. But then when I look at their kind of soft power and like how they are trying to be coercive towards us, they clearly don't understand how to really appeal to Americans. And I think that that is still something that we really have on everybody else. Even with Hollywood going crazy and woke, our biggest export is culture. Chinese people want to watch American movies. The CCP could shut that down and say, okay, you can't. They've threatened that, which would be terrible for Hollywood. But I mean, we know like our culture is just so light years ahead of any other country.
It is wild to me, like not to get sidetracked, but when I watch social media and I see how all of these foreign countries, Western, all from anywhere, like how familiar they are with the United States, how much media they consume from the United States, and like how they just boldly have an opinion about how things should be run here. Basically on the movies that they watch and the TV shows that they watch and the news that they watch all the time. Like, it's wild to me. I'm like,
it's crazy.
I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about, but you feel like you know what you're talking about because that is what they're consuming all the time. So I do want to switch gears though, and kind of move it a little back domestically, but still foreign policy affiliated. Mm-hmm. It is Department of Defense.
Yeah.
Okay. So there has been, the news cycle is insane. I can only follow so many things. I'm fully aware I was very much into obviously following Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense's confirmation, the first Signalgate scandal with Jeffrey Goldberg, which I had many opinions about that. I think it was a nothing, basically, that was tried to be made into something. And then now there's allegedly a second Signalgate. And in addition to that, which we have yet to see, like The Atlantic actually released the text messages. The text messages of the second Signalgate have yet to be released. And the allegation is that Hegseth shared secret or confidential information on a text thread with his attorney, his brother, and his wife. Now, his attorney and his brother, you might be able to explain, because a lot of people don't know that his brother is within the DOD.
And his attorney.
And his attorney. Mm-hmm. I don't know about his wife needing to be in on the conversation.
It's giving Bill Belichick's girlfriend a little bit. Do you know what I'm talking
about? That is hilarious. I love that comparison.
It is a little bit. But they met at work.
Yeah.
You know, she was a producer at Fox News, and they've always had a working relationship. So I don't know.
And then it's also a question of like, how sensitive was this information? But that has not been revealed to us. Now, in addition to that, like the last Trump administration, probably not to the same degree, there have been issues with leaks. There was leaks about Trump's like policy with the Panama Canal. There has been leaks with the Signalgate stuff. There's been multiple leaks, okay? And to the point where there has been an investigation, or at least there is a claim that there is an investigation into the leaks believed to be coming out from the DOD. Mm-hmm. Then in the process of that investigation, there were three individuals who were fired from the Department of Defense. And so there's been apparently like a lot of recent drama at the Department of Defense. So the three firings, which are pretty significant, were Dan Caldwell, which is significant because he has a previous relationship, like friendly relationship with Hegseth. He was with him, I think, in the Concerned Veterans for America. Like they worked together in that organization. And he joined the DOD and came to work at the request. Like he is a Hegseth friend and confidant. Dan Caldwell was dismissed. Colin Carroll, he was the chief of staff to the Deputy of Defense Secretary Stephen Feinberg. And then Darren Selnick, who was Deputy Chief of Staff to Hegseth. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't mention, but Caldwell was the senior advisor to Hegseth. Mm-hmm. So they're all close proximity, I think, except for Carroll. Carroll, he was like, I think I listened to his interview with Megyn Kelly.
Megyn Kelly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he was more like an administrative position. Like he wasn't a policy guy. It was more like administration within the DOD, get stuff done type of guy. Mm-hmm. And then over all of that, there was this other dude called Joe Casper. Mm-hmm. And he was the chief of staff for Hegseth. When these firings happened, Casper wasn't fired, but he either resigned or was reassigned. I think there's some conflicting information there. But the claim is from the three individuals who were fired, which include Dan Caldwell, that Joe Casper was like a problem and that there was a lot of conflict amongst the team. And they seem to collectively, they did put out a joint statement, I think on X, where he says, "We are incredibly disappointed by the manner in which our service at the Department of Defense ended. Unnamed Pentagon officials have slandered our character with baseless attacks on our way out the door. At this time, we still have not been told what exactly we're investigated for, if there's still an active investigation, or if there was even a real investigation of leaks to begin with. While this experience has been unconscionable, we remain supportive of the Trump-Vance administration's mission to make the Pentagon great again and achieve peace through strength." So Caldwell went and did an interview with Tucker Carlson. And what I'm getting overall is that it seems chaotic to me, but I don't know if that's like a fair assumption. I don't know if this is a leadership issue with Hegseth. I don't know if Hegseth is being influenced and convinced that these people needed to go. It looks suspicious to me that maybe of whether or not they actually leaked, considering devices weren't taken away. I don't know. Like, you tell me, what the heck is happening over there?
First of all, this is being framed in the media as it's like an isolationist versus neocon thing. I don't think that has anything to do with what happened. And I think the reason that they're going to frame it that way is because Dan Caldwell and these other guys are not going to have a career with any other type of administration other than a Trump Vance administration. If you had a Nikki Haley type Republican, they have no space in it.
And just because people may not know, Caldwell, he is former, like he was in the military. He served in the Iraq war. Since that, just like many of us who went through the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are just not interested in that type of intervention again. Mm-hmm. And so one of the in the interviews, there was a lot of discussion about how the Department of Defense is advising on how to deal with Iran specifically. Mm-hmm. And so there's a narrative forming that Caldwell is very isolationist and not interested in engaging at all with Iran, and that there are people that are advising Hegseth, even though he's not completely isolationist, he is hesitant on engaging with Iran, but that he's being advised otherwise. Am I correct in how I'm summarizing that, and like what the root of that isolationist versus neocon talking point is coming from?
Really quick on that too, when people are talking about war with Iran, we're not going to war with Iran. And that really needs to be, like, when they say, I'm going to be mad.
Nobody
wants a war with Iran. And I would be mad if there was a single U.S. troop on Iranian soil. We're not going to send troops in. Before the Gulf War, the first one, we had 200,000 troops in the Middle East ready to go for Kuwait. Okay? We have 40,000 across the Middle East right now. We're not stacking troops in the Middle East like we're going to war. We're not going to war with Iran. A war with Iran is a 10-hour airstrike campaign on a couple nuclear sites, mostly led by the Israelis. If we allow that to happen, again, my biggest worry with this administration is the allowance of nuclear proliferation. One of the ways you put that in the bud is you take out rogue actors trying to get nuclear weapons.
But you don't think if there were strikes in Iran that that would end up with some form of escalation in the Middle East? No.
No.
And no, I think that is what a lot of people are concerned about.
Well, I think they're concerned about regime change and sending in troops on the ground. Again, we're not getting ready for that at all. And unless we're about to have a massive deployment of every troop we have stationed over here, and we're going to send every single one of them over there, then maybe. But no, we're just trying to climb out of a recruitment crisis. That's not going to happen. When the Israelis struck last summer, they took out all of their ballistic missile factories. So the only ballistic missiles the Iranians have right now are the ones that were already manufactured. They haven't rebuilt those factories. They don't have air defense systems. We sent another THAAD battery, which would like help intercept if they were to retaliate ballistic missiles. But they're not going to expend everything that they have. We have a long history of when we strike the Iranians where it hurts on their soil, they don't strike back. Qasem Soleimani is a case of that. When Reagan took out their entire Navy, they stood down. So, I mean, no, I don't think that we would see a significant response from the Iranians. I think the good probably outweighs the bad. I think that Caldwell and these guys probably see the writing on the wall and know that we will more than likely take strikes against Iran, and they're going to frame it as, well, I was so against it, and that's why I left. Because, yeah, I mean, like, these guys aren't...
So you think that these three individuals are using that talking point to cover for themselves? Is that what you're kind of, like, alluding
to? I think Caldwell
to?
Was... Yeah, I think that Caldwell was in his Tucker Carlson interview. I don't know. I listened to the same one you did with... What's his name? Colin?
I got my notes here. Colin Carroll.
I knew the first one. I listened to his too. Maybe he's not so much that way too, but I kind of believe that these firings probably happened because of internal disputes. And that kind of goes back to a 101 level of, okay, you keep your deputies happy, you keep your chiefs of staff happy at the DOD. And if you can't kind of control that, what else are you letting get out of control? And to me, that's what I think, that this is just like internal politics. That's, again, these people want jobs in the future, so they're going to try and do that.
I don't know. Say for Hegseth's leadership,
not great.
Oh, okay. See, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, unfortunately,
because that first of all, like, as soon as this happened, or shortly after this happened, he made a public statement. He made two public statements. Like, he did one at the Easter egg role. And then I think another one during an interview with Fox News, I can't remember exactly. I don't know if it was Will Cain who was interviewing him, but it doesn't matter. The point being is that his claim, which he seemed very, I don't know, it's like the way he talks sometimes. I don't know if it's because he's a TV personality that it comes off as like a TV personality, like performative. But, you know, his claim was these are disgruntled employees who he was saying that they leaked, even though he would caveat that with that is being investigated and we'll see. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, if this was actually just like internal politicking drama, my question is, what does it say for the leadership of Hegseth that he can't get that under control, that he can't get people lined up, and that when they don't, like, I get not the worst thing Biden did was keeping people, like, never firing anyone. Yeah. So I totally don't have a problem with firing someone if they're not capable of doing their job. But also, if you're firing people and then claiming, I don't know, that they're being fired because of leaking and then providing no evidence of leaking, and then the report is actually drama, which then under, like, mines your capabilities as a manager. Like, it just doesn't instill a whole bunch of confidence. And it's not even to say that Hegseth isn't been beneficial, especially considering recruitment numbers are up and he has a way of being able to deliver the president's goals. But again, there seems to be like a management issue here. And I feel like it would be unfair for us to be like, oh, no, that's just, yes, the media is going after him. But there's other elements contributing to this that kind of confirm that there could be a problem here that are outside of what the media is saying.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say, and I don't know if I've said this to you before, if there's anybody I know well in politics or used to know in politics, it's Pete Hegseth.
Yes. Yeah.
He's Minnesotan, so I've actually spent a lot of time with him, and he never drank too much around us, and he was never creepy to the young girls, and he was one of the few that wasn't creepy. And like, I feel very defensive towards him for that, and like, I really do feel for him, and I think he's an amazing guy, and I do think that he's done a good job with recruitment and stuff like that at the DOD, so it kind of breaks my heart with this, but I do kind of see, like, even what you're saying, what your wheels are turning, I'm like, okay, this might be a little off. The fact that Megyn Kelly and Tucker Carlson had people on who were like, oh, this isn't good. And I like Pete, but this isn't good.
Yeah. And Megyn Kelly worked with him too. Like, she was the one that brought him over to Fox News. And so she has even acknowledged, like, something is weird. Somebody, like, I feel like everybody's CYA currently, but I've obviously, it's enough to where I think Hegseth is also doing it. And I don't know if it's out of insecurity in the position that he's in. Is it because it's like a byproduct of the media, like 100% negative reporting on Hegseth? Mm-hmm. There's no positives reported on him about recruitment, about the strikes on the Houthis, on there have been missions that the DOD have conducted since he's been Secretary of Defense that have been objectively successful. But that's not reported on.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's that part of it too. I mean, I think he kind of put himself in a hard position, or he was put in a hard position, because when his stuff was on the line, like when he might have been pulled, his confirmation, he went out and he fought for himself in the media.
Yeah.
And now he's,
I feel like he's not doing it.
He kind of was at the Easter egg roll, but it's okay. I don't know that you're helping yourself. Actually, Sean Spicer's theory on this, I think, is probably the closest to accurate.
Oh, yes. I think I heard that when on Two-Way, which, by the way, if you guys are not listening to Two-Way, like, I listen to that every morning. I don't listen sometimes when the people start asking questions, but when it's
Mark and Sean and
Ben. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the best shows.
Required listening, in my opinion, for if you want to know what's going on, because Mark has really good sources, and he now has his podcast on the Megyn Kelly Network. But so, I actually think Sean Spicer's theory, where it's, oh no, I think Elon was involved somehow and Pete chose to cover for Elon, and that had to mean a couple firings. And I think that that's where this is.
I don't remember that. Elon was involved how?
So I think right when you started to see the leaking stuff happening, there was that headline that Elon was about to get a briefing or something on China, and Trump actually stepped in and said, okay, no, he has no business in that because he has business with the Chinese. We're not going to show him war plans with China.
Yeah,
so
that
leaked and got out. And I think Spicer's theory had some, I mean, I haven't heard it again in a few weeks, but I think his theory was something along the lines of these guys are Pete loyalists. Maybe they put something out to the press on background and said kind of to cover for Pete. And then Pete was approached like, hey, some of your guys are leaking stuff that is looking bad for you and looking bad for Elon. And so you got to fire a couple people. You know what I mean? They can't be doing that. And
I
so
see.
I think
because
that's where he was at.
That and, would make sense.
And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And it makes sense if you listen to the interviews with Tucker and with especially Carol with Megyn Kelly, because, gosh, I wish I could remember the details, but he did make mention of, like, there was an email where he did a response that was, like, approved, but then that was used against him because he, like, responded to a comment from the media. And I don't remember like the substance of that, but that was used as evidence as that he was someone that was in communications with the media. And so he was possibly someone that, because even though in this process of these firings, he was implicated as not being the primary target, but maybe having like affiliated or proximity to potential leaks, which seems to me very vague as opposed to like he did XYZ. And I think that's one of the things that's concerning to me because it is Hegseth and the leadership who is saying these men leaked. But all of these alleged leaks are speculative. There's no evidence of them. And just like I'm expecting the media to provide evidence when they're saying that Hegseth shared confidential information in a text thread with his wife, I would expect this administration, which is trying to portray themselves as one of the most transparent administrations there is, to be like, if you're going to be accusing career government officials, people who have reputations, with leaking sensitive information or working against the administration, which is really weird with Caldwell because he has been a hardcore Trump guy from day one. I don't know, provide some evidence of that. And I think that's what makes me like concerned. And I know there was like a lot of noise or conversation about how this was, like you mentioned, like neocon versus isolationist, that Susan Rice was on the DOD Defense Policy Board. I think Caldwell actually brought that up in the Tucker interview. She was later removed, but that was presented as evidence of Hegseth maybe siding with or being influenced, like a deep state influence with like more neocon-y ideas. But I don't know. Like, to me, I've been trying to kind of work it out. And I think that theory makes almost the most sense.
That's what I think. I can't really make of what's happening either. There's a lot of moving
and
parts.
And everybody's speculating. It's not just, yeah. There's no affirmative anything for anyone.
Yeah. And when people talk about, oh, I mean, I don't know. Trump does fire people.
And yeah, for sure.
He likes to fire multiple people at once. And I don't know. I don't know that Mike Waltz fully recovered from the signal gate. I mean, he was kind of the one that was like the most at fault there. Hegseth is kind of in constant turmoil. I don't think you want to fire two, like the Department of Defense and the National Security Advisor.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we're mulling strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. So I don't really know. And I've heard that Lutnick might be out soon. So we got to see. I mean,
just let's do a flashback for that, because I would be disappointed. But this isn't weird for Trump. And actually, it's not weird for most administrations, because a lot of times a new administration will come in, the teams get pulled together, then there's internal dynamics, because this is a lot of pride in these teams. A lot of men and women in positions of power jockeying for covering their backs, and there's a lot of politicking. And in the first administration, the biggest challenge was Trump had to quickly put a team together, because honestly, I don't think he thought he was going to win.
No.
And he wasn't a politician, so he wasn't like, it's not like career politicians who have these advisors that are already getting transition teams put together. Like, he had to quickly put his team together, which ended up with a lot of internal conflict because there was people that actively tried to undermine his agenda. Now, this time around, he had way more time to put a team together. He chose these people. And so I would be disappointed if he chose poorly.
especially considering all the time that he had. However, it's sometimes like maybe he didn't choose. I don't know if I was going to give anybody kind of like a little bit of benefit. He chose who he liked. But once you end up dealing with interpersonal dynamics, those things can change. And so it would be frustrating if we are yet again in a position like we were in the first administration, where in the beginning there was just like a lot of change up because of dynamics within the cabinet. I do think it's not nearly as bad as the first time around because obviously the motives are different. This is a team that is mostly in support of the president and not actively trying to undermine him. But it just adds another challenge to the administration when we have a very short period of time
to get things done.
So it is frustrating. So I know you like Hegseth, and for the most part, I guess we're on the same page, and like in his, there's questions on his management abilities.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, it's kind of one of those things where it's a chicken and egg problem where I agree that the media is just going at him and they're not giving him any of the benefit of the doubt. But at the same time, you can't have the Department of Defense head just constantly bogged down with the media. You know what I mean? And yeah, at some point he needs to push back. But at some point that, like, it can't be that he has to deal with the media and all these constant scandals, some of which are manufactured, some of which might have some validity, and then also be running the largest bureaucracy in our government and trying to increase recruitment and coordinate these strikes and all the, I mean, that's like a lot to have on your plate. Yeah.
Do you think he's going to make it?
He could. I don't know.
People can't see your face, and I love your face and your like silence.
I want him to.
I know. And I don't necessarily, there was a lot of questions about him and his abilities. And I was really hopeful because, and I am rooting for him because I don't want the standard. I don't want, I don't know, some other former general that's like jockeying for, is more concerned about his retirement versus serving this administration. And I think that's probably like my concern is that the pool of people that you can put in that position that's really going to align with the president is small.
That's what I'm thinking. I don't even know who they would replace him with.
That's my thing. That's why I'm like, I feel like it's like a chicken in the hard place. You know what I mean? Chicken in the hard place. I don't even know what that means. And so I'm like, because I was having that thought too. I'm like, who are they going to put in his place? I can't think of who they would put in his place.
I have no idea.
All right. We're 100 days in, Amanda. So far, what do we have? We have a trade war with China. We have a mineral deal with Ukraine. Maybe a peace deal with Russia and Ukraine. I have no idea what is happening in Israel and Gaza at this point. I feel like all of this other noise has been happening that I don't necessarily know what is happening with Israel and Gaza and what we're doing in relation to that.
It's more of the same.
Like I feel like nothing has really changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's constant negotiations to try and get hostages back. Israel went back in on the ground. We heard it was going to be this big, overwhelming, actual, really intense fight. And I've not seen that. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm not seeing things, but I heard that they were going to really up the intensity and kind of take the gloves off. I don't think that they really have. I think that they're doing kind of the same that they were before. And maybe the only exception being that they're now taking and holding territory. This maybe is getting too in the weeds, but the way Israel's fought this war over the last 2 years is that they'll go in and they'll kind of get rid of Hamas in that area, and then they'll leave that area. And then once they leave, Hamas goes right back into that area. I think that they were fighting the war that way because they understood, just like with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, that this would end in some sort of a ceasefire deal, and hopefully Hamas would be kicked out, but maybe not. When Trump came in and Trump kind of signaled, no, I'm going to let you kind of fight this till the end, they start maybe changing up, but I thought that they would up the intensity and they really haven't. We've not seen progress on a peace deal. I think that one's going to be a slow burn.
Okay. And that's why I was thinking, I was like, I haven't heard anything about like any other countries coming together, anything at all in relation to, and I don't even know exactly what Israel until just now. I had no idea what Israel was doing with Gaza or what the situation was there. So that one is, I guess, kind of like at a standstill. Not like there wasn't enough going on. Not a standstill, but like a holding pattern, I guess, because they are still fighting. It's not like they're in a, they're not in a ceasefire right now, correct?
No. Yeah, they're fighting. I mean, to me, what to watch with Israel is I think that the new Syrian regime, the Saudis, if they can kick Hezbollah fully out, the Lebanese, Indonesia, maybe Malaysia, Pakistan. I mean, we're going to see a lot of these countries join the Abraham Accords.
Yeah.
So that to me is what to keep your eye on.
All right. So far, 100 days in. How is he doing?
I'm cautiously optimistic. Again, the first 4 years were pretty chaotic, but I think the world felt a lot safer, especially looking back. The chaos, as uncomfortable as it can be to watch, it is also uncomfortable for our adversaries, and it makes them want to stay put, not act.
Yeah.
And so we have to remember that when Trump's going out saying one thing, saying the other thing. I mean, that's another thing with these Iranian negotiations. You keep hearing, like, most of the stuff that's leaking is coming from pro-Iranian sources saying, oh, the U.S. is going to give up everything. I don't think we're going to give up everything. And Pete Hegseth tweeted last night, we're going to strike you at the time and place of our choosing because you have not complied. So we might see something there. I'm pretty happy with it. I'm cautiously optimistic that things move forward. There's still a lot that can go wrong. We need to get some of these trade deals done. We need to deter China from invading Taiwan.
We have only, I don't know, I don't know how many days left. So many days left. So much more can happen. I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up for today's episode. First of all, thank you so much for joining me. I did an interview. So Rachel left me one time to go to England and I did the podcast by myself and I absolutely hated it because like, I like to talk to people. So, I mean, I kind of do, but I like to talk to people one-on-one. So I really appreciate that you got up early this morning and you joined me on today's podcast to talk about Trump's first 100 days in Trump 2.0 focused on foreign policy. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And if people want more, my TikTok is Amanda Talks Geopolitics, my YouTube, I have stuff coming out. Amanda Talks Geopolitics, my ex. And I have a true crime podcast that I'm about to roll out a second season. So
I will definitely keep all of those links in the show notes if you want to follow Amanda. I recommend it, especially if you guys are on TikTok. She does some great little recaps there and everything. So she is a great follow on TikTok and on X. And that's it for today's episode of Rivera and Reeves. Make sure you go and you follow Amanda. And I will see you again with Rachel next week on Tuesday for another episode of Rivera and Reeves. If this is your first time here, congratulations. You have found your new favorite podcast. Make sure you hit that follow button. Give us a 5-star rating and leave us a comment. It helps the podcast grow. But what helps us grow even more is if you share the podcast because the algorithms apparently hate us. So that would be nice. Also, if you don't want any advertisements, you want some bonus content and to join the conversation on Substack, please click the link in the show notes and consider becoming a paying supporter. It really helps us and it's a lot of fun for you. And that's it. Also, check out our merch because it's bomb. And that's all I have for today. Thanks, Amanda. Okay, you guys. Bye.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.